Hello and welcome back to Podcast from the Edge with me, Peter Bruce. We're far away, but the attempted assassination of Donald Trump at the weekend is going to seriously change all of our lives. Until the shot that just missed him, while on a stump in Pennsylvania last Saturday, Trump was beatable, especially if his opponent in the November U.S. presidential election, President Joe Biden, were to drop out of the race. Biden's physical and mental frailties were anyway rendering him pretty unelectable 4 months out. But there was always a chance the Democratic Party could persuade him to release his pledged delegates at the Democratic Convention in Chicago next month. A younger, sharper Democratic candidate would have given Trump a run for his money. But now it's probably too late. Trump's brush with death and his defiant response to it seconds afterwards have seen his prospects soar, and for the moment at least, it's hard to imagine any Democrat beating him in November. Against this background, the Chinese Communist Party began a private or behind closed doors meeting in Beijing on Monday with its leader Xi Jinping, preparing to set out a vision for China's immediate future as it faces slower growth and mounting economic problems at home and increasing resistance to its aggressive trade policies abroad. The world is on edge. Russia is still invading Ukraine with conspicuous Chinese support. The Chinese continue to threaten Taiwan, which the U.S. in turn has sworn to defend. In the South China Sea, large parts of which Beijing claims, Chinese Coast Guard vessels do constant, though so far non-lethal, battle with Filipino fishermen over access to tiny spits of land that both countries claim belongs to them. The Philippines is a vital U.S. ally in the region. The lasting legacy of Donald Trump's first term of the U.S. from 2016 to 2020 was the beginning of a trade war with China that Biden pursued with perhaps even more vigor. Trump's return promises yet more as the U.S. tries to turn back imports of Chinese technology and now electric vehicles. The exports are vital to the Chinese economy, and a standoff looms as China tries now directly to challenge the U.S. for global leadership across a wide range of fronts. South Africa is desperately trying to escape the consequences to come, but it may be too late. With me today to try and navigate through these complexities is Elizabeth Sideropoulos, Chief Executive of the South African Institute of International Affairs, which she's led since 2005. She's got 2 decades of experience in politics, international relations, South African foreign policy, South-South cooperation, and the role of emerging powers in Africa. Elizabeth is the co-chair of the Think 20 Africa Standing Group, established in 2017, and she serves on the second high-level advisory board of the United Nations Economic and Social Affairs Department. And Elizabeth, thank you so much for joining me, the more so as I know you're recovering from the flu. I suppose it's really too easy to exaggerate the state of the world today, but I'm a post-war baby, and I've never been more alarmed about the state of the world. Is it just me?
Good afternoon, Peter, and it's not just you. I think even some of us who are a little after the immediate post-war would feel the same way. I think we are entering extremely dangerous territory. I'm not quite sure who the adults in the room are and whether there is any real desire from the actors that matter to really seriously aim to de-escalate a lot of these tensions that you have already outlined in your introduction, whether it is in the South China Sea, in Eastern Europe, in the Middle East, or indeed what is happening in the U.S. I think it is apposite that we should all be quite concerned about where the world is going, and the absence, I would also add, of real leadership, which makes that even more dangerous.
So I was born in 1952 in the middle of the Korean War, and the divisions today seem to be exactly as they were then. I mean, basically, it's the West on one side, China and Russia on the other. How is it possible that none of this has been resolved? I mean, why does that particular trio of powers still look the same today in terms of its positioning as it did, well, 70 years ago?
It is the same, and it's also not the same. Clearly, The world has really changed significantly over the last 70 years. If we think of the Soviet Union in 1952, China was then, of course, just emerging out of its civil war. But if we reflect on the Soviet Union and its trajectory from the end of the Second World War all the way to 1989, it wasn't in an economic position that China is today, for example. China is very much part of the globalized world. It's benefited exceedingly from the system that that pretty much became universal after 1991. And of course, it is an economic power that can rival the U.S. I think the Soviet Union really never was in that position. But having said that, we're talking here about three really big countries geographically and in terms of population, with, in the case of Russia, obviously still a nuclear-powered state with significant military capabilities and, important natural resources. In the case of China, of course, it's a different economic makeup, one that while it started off, 40 years ago or so, more than 40 years ago, as a fairly poor country, is now actually really competing, not just on basic manufacturing, but actually really has boosted its technological prowess and is now seriously competing with the best in innovation and scientific endeavor in the West. The political systems are part of the issue here of this contestation. The fact that China is a rising power and is reminiscent of what Thucydides said about Athens and Sparta. So we have a situation where you have the U.S. as a declining power in relative terms, and China really contesting that, and the U.S. pushing back, wanting to retain its predominance and its global hegemony. And so these tensions were bound to come to the fore. The question is whether they're going to end up in war. And in the case of Russia, of course, we're talking about a situation that really is an attempt to finalize and to bring to an end, I suppose, or to resolve the unresolved end of the Soviet Union in 1991. Yugoslavia went through a civil war in the 1990s and saw its dismemberment into six, now seven, I think, independent states. In the case of Russia, at least the 15 Soviet republics, and particularly Ukraine and Belarus, who were part of bringing the Soviet Union to the end. The issues of Russian minorities living in those countries, the constant threat that Russia feels under of attack from across the North European plain, these are all issues that have made this context contest what it is today.
Is war? Is a wider war really possible? The Chinese, as you say, rich and powerful now, and the more rich and more powerful, the more belligerent they seem to become. Why would Xi Jinping, just as Russia was about to invade Ukraine, declare that he and Russia, or Beijing and Moscow, were everlasting allies? Why would he feel it necessary to do that, other than to sort of declare, an out confrontation with the West or the US? Do the Chinese need Russia?
I think, clearly, if you compare it again to 70 years ago, China is now the senior partner in the relationship. I suppose Russia, I would argue, Russia needs China more than the other way around. But Russia is still a very important global player, not least in military terms, and also has significant reserves of oil and gas, which, a few years before the no-holds-barred friendship of 2022, there was an agreement between Russia and China for pipelines to pipe gas into China at very favorable rates, even at that time. is important for China, even though this is now the second superpower in the world, it is important for China to also establish a grouping of friends and partners. We're not talking about a NATO alliance or the kind of a partnership that you see in the West, but it's certainly important for China to build those up also in its in the contestation that comes up in the South China Sea and in other parts of the world where its interests are.
Is that where BRICS would then come from? I mean, is BRICS, and I was going to ask you this question later on, but does BRICS perform that role? In other words, BRICS kind of fronts for China across a wide range of, you know, diplomatic fronts, the UN or the G20 or whatever it might be. Is that its purpose? Because it's hard to see, you know, people, South Africa particularly now, as it tries to sort of backpedal or repedal or reposition, keeps trying to sort of, you know, portray the BRICS as you know, little more than a sort of discussion group of not really even like-minded countries. But are they, you know, are we all just useful idiots to the Chinese who need us for a wider purpose?
I think BRICS is one of a number of groupings that that China uses or that China sees as helpful to its own rise. It's not the most, I would argue it's not the most important, but it is certainly one of those sort of groupings in a concentric circle that really helps to project its influence and its power. The Belt and Road Initiative, for example, is another such such sort of, let's call it a grouping, where China, using its financial clout, has been able to sort of create good friends through building infrastructure and so on and connectivity, which is a positive thing for those countries in and of itself. I mean, we can talk about debt later and debt, the issue of China and debt, I think, has also somewhat been sometimes misconstrued as an entirely Chinese problem, but it is very much part of sort of China. Sort of, I don't think we're useful idiots. Let me put it that way. I don't think we're entirely useful idiots. I think there are benefits that both South Africa and other countries, whether in the BRICS or in the Belt and Road, do derive from being in those groupings and from being good friends with China. And but it is very much about China's sphere of influence. It's about the sort of Middle Kingdom, sort of spreading its wings.
So I mean, so who's winning? You know, I mean, is the West, is this a new cold? Are we in a new Cold War? Is the West losing? America, is, as you say, is a diminishing power, but it's fighting back. Or should it fight back? I was listening to a former advisor to Donald Trump on another podcast recently, and he was basically arguing, and he was a military advisor to Trump. He was arguing that the West should, or the American, the U.S., should fight back, should stop the Chinese spreading, it's the spread of Chinese influence, should stop the spread of Russian influence by whatever means, you know. And but I guess the question is, who's winning? You know, big oil producers like Iran are now no longer in the camp they were in 1952. I mean, what's the state of play? Is war imminent? And there's some very close, you know, it's only going to take an idiot to do something rash one day, heroic pilot to fly into, you know, an American warship in the South China Sea or something like that. I mean, what is militarily, strength-wise, what's the state of play in your mind? And diplomatically, I suppose.
Yeah, so militarily, clearly, the U.S. still has the upper hand. I think let's make no mistakes in that category. This is still the predominant military power. Of course, over the last several years, China has been building up its military capacity, not least also in aircraft carriers and so on. And it has certainly increased its budget allocated to defense quite a lot over the last several years. I think the point, you know, is war imminent? I think the issue here is reminiscent, potentially reminiscent a little bit of the First World War. And I think here of the book by Christopher Clark called The Sleepwalkers, where he basically makes the point, and I'm going to simplify the argument, that, you know, nobody really wanted a world war in 1914. But a whole bunch of factors and issues ended up in the situation where not only where the assassination of the Archduke led to a global war. So they sleepwalked into that. And that is exactly, I think, what is very worrying in the current environment, particularly where relations between the Chinese military and the U.S. military have for a period not happened. I know that at some point, I think last year it was, and I stand to be corrected now, some of these connections and communications began again. I don't know where the situation is at the moment, but that is a very, very important dimension of trying to manage a situation where you have two rival powers. It was very important during the Cold War that there was a sort of an open line between Moscow and Washington, D.C. to make sure that there was, you know, there was no misunderstanding about certain things that happened. And in the absence of that, or in the absence of really a sense that each side actually understands the other's red lines and knows up to a point what the response of the one or the other side might be. So it's about knowing your opponent well. In the absence of that, it becomes much more dangerous. And war then, not by design, but by mistake, can become a possibility. And one of the areas of concern, I mean, we talk a lot about Taiwan, but one of the areas is increasingly, and you mentioned it in your introduction, the Philippines. Where, you know, there's been this running sort of to and fro on some of the atolls.
Well, it's hard to know, especially in a place where there are so many potential trigger points for an act of madness to occur. How do you rank them? I mean, so we haven't even mentioned, you know, the Middle East or Israel and Gaza. But presumably, in terms of the things that would trigger, that would have to trigger an American response, Israel probably is, you know, ahead of the rest in a way. I mean, the Americans, Democrat or Republican, and particularly with Trump coming back into power, possibly, probably, any real threat to Israel could really become a really serious thing. You know, when Antony Blinken was in Beijing earlier this year, somebody was telling me, or maybe I heard it somewhere, that Blinken was in Beijing and he met the senior Chinese officials. But he was in, but they also met on the same day in Beijing a delegation from Hamas. They didn't apparently even tell Blinken. So, you know, such as their sort of disregard for this is the way I heard the story. For the Americans at the moment, that they, you know, whatever relationship they have, they didn't really make much effort to tell Blinken that while he was in Beijing, Hamas was already also there, and they were going to see them this afternoon. I mean, it does sound, where do these, in terms of the sort of hierarchy of threat, where is the easiest place to start a war now? Ukraine is already, you know, there's already a war there, so that's kind of under control in a way.
Yeah, and I think just reflecting on Ukraine, clearly both the U.S. and most European states certainly have exercised restraint from the perspective of, you know, how you use, what weapons you sell to Ukraine, how Ukraine is allowed to use them or not, or where Ukraine is allowed to use them or not. And so certainly that's been, there's been great care taken not to provoke a situation where Article 5 of NATO has to be actioned and end up in a war with Russia. So I think that you know, I don't want to say that's a positive development. Certainly, if one is sitting in Ukraine, one doesn't see it necessarily that way. But that, you know, from a great power perspective, I think it's a responsible approach. I mean, it's really difficult to rank anything or to say where the next inflection point might be. Certainly, when it comes to Israel, I think we've seen the way in which the U.S. and certainly particularly Congress or members of Congress have responded, also to the way in which South Africa has engaged in the ICJ on this. I don't think that we will see necessarily troops on the ground in the middle in Israel and Palestine from America, if that were the case. But I think sort of a continued and even heightened support, military support of the kind that is already there, is probably going to be something that that might be accelerated, depending on the circumstances on the ground. What happens with Iran is the big issue there, and obviously this is Israel's existential foe, and obviously what happens with its proxies is in Lebanon. But there again, I wouldn't see necessarily the U.S. sort of putting troops on the ground and creating another sort of major conflagration. I think the area where one is really concerned is in East Asia. It is in the Pacific. You know, for a long time, you know, that has been the U.S.'s
backyard.
Should I call it playground?
Yeah.
And where it has a number of very important allies, and economically is a very, very important region.
And fortunately for the U.S., China has antagonized quite a few countries in the area by claiming atolls or islands that have historically belonged to either Vietnam or the Philippines and other countries. Elizabeth, what is a Trump presidency, which looks more likely now than it did a week ago? But let's not call it 100% yet. But what, in theory, does a Trump presidency do to the world? You know, it's interesting the way he bullied NATO in his first term. The result of all of that is that NATO actually sort of half listened, you know, and they have begun to spend more on defense. They are now all but, you know, most of them are either at or above the 2% of GDP military spending target that he set them. You know, if Donald finds that threatening sort of traditional allies works to that extent, do we see more of it, or is he interested in what they do? It's hard to read him. Some people would call him basically just a Russian plant, which seems to me a bit simplistic. What does the Trump presidency do? Let's not talk about South Africa for the moment. We'll come to that. What does it do to the world? How less or more secure are we? I mean, if we've got a frightening guy in Washington, as you say, the biggest military in the world, perhaps everybody calms down a bit.
So the one big issue that we learned out of the first Trump presidency is that, you know, he's not always entirely predictable.
No.
Or he can. He's very predictable in his unpredictability, perhaps. And that's that's never a good thing for diplomacy, of course. You know, you need to be able to read your opponent, as I think I said earlier, so that we don't end up in situations that we all regret it. So that's the one point. I think absolutely of what he's done for NATO through his bullying is to really galvanize the other members to really begin ramping up their defense spending. Something which probably, you know, I think the Europeans themselves will recognize they had slacked off on, and which now is a problem if Trump were indeed to win and he were to pull out of, or he would, you know, sort of become disengaged from NATO, whether America pulled out completely or not, and certainly sort of terminated support for Ukraine. His VP, his new vice president, vice presidential candidate.
J.D. Vance.
Yep. J.D. Vance basically is of the view that, you know, let the Europeans sort it out. It's their problem. And so the many years of focusing on the economy and not focusing on defense and the military certainly may now be a high cost to pay for the Europeans. They are, I think, from a European perspective, real concerns, of course, about isolationism, a sort of America retreating in certain areas, I would say. I think in the case of Israel, we might see a much more bullish Trump supporting Israel's interest, but nevertheless, yeah. a withdrawal of sorts from Europe. I think overall, a decision not to be the world's policeman. I mean, it's been something that it hasn't really done very effectively for some time, anyway. But certainly in certain places, it's been important, certainly as not in terms of troops on the ground, but in terms of somebody able to bring parties together and knock heads together. So isolationism is not necessarily a good thing. Who fills that vacuum and how? And then the other point, of course, economically is the issue of protectionism, which he certainly drove during his first term. I think the thing about Trump is he articulated so many things that many people wanted to articulate but felt it wasn't politically appropriate or politically correct to do so. Once he had articulated that, I think, you know, we saw it also in the Biden administration. He didn't really roll back any of the protectionist. In fact, he increased them. He's just, you know, he just does it in a different way, in a less combative way than Trump. So I think those are the two sort of key elements that one has to really worry about. And the issue of unpredictability, I think, and follow through. You know, if I think again of the first administration and his efforts at engaging with North Korea, I mean, they came to nothing. And I think we're probably in a worse spot right now than we were maybe eight or so years ago.
Yeah. What is it about American isolationism? Because on the one hand, you know, and it's got a history to it, doesn't it? I mean, America joined the war in the Second World War only after it was attacked at Pearl Harbor, after the Japanese attack on its fleet in Pearl Harbor. It had been completely nonchalant about Japanese military aggression in China and other parts of Southeast Asia. Up until that point, didn't want to get involved. It didn't want to get involved with Europe. And it took actual attacks on American capital in a way that the Pearl Harbor was one. And then I think the Germans torpedoed an American ship in the Atlantic. And that gave the government an excuse to then say, okay, well, we're going to join the war effort. At the same time as being isolationist, they are this huge military power, and there's no evidence in Trump. Trump is not calling for a reduction in the scale, in the size of the American military at all. How do you get to be isolationist and sort of nationalist at the same time? What's the object here? I mean, if you're going to be nationalist, you want to impose yourself. If you want to be isolationist, you're sort of saying, no, we don't. We don't want anything to do with anybody. Who are these people?
I think I'm not going to try to answer the American, no. You know, explaining the American psyche. I think the point I think that is important to make, or at least the way I see Trump, is that he certainly doesn't want to be encumbered by any treaties such as NATO and sort of multilateral agreements that bind his ability to act. Now, this has been an issue for the U.S. for a long time, right? It's the characteristic of any great power. You don't want to be necessarily in a situation where you have to comply with the rules that everybody else has to comply with. You don't have to. You're a great power. You can get away with a lot. And indeed, the U.S. has gotten away with a lot. China is behaving in a similar way. It doesn't necessarily want to be encumbered by rules, and Russia has been pretty much the same. And I think what Trump is doing is sort of taking it to another level, in terms particularly of his approach and what he has articulated with regard to Europe and NATO and so on. That is probably only a partial answer, and there are obviously there are lots of dynamics in American society, part of which is the fact that there is a large number of Americans, some of whom and about which the Trump's vice presidential candidate has written about, who feel completely marginalized, feel that they have been left behind by globalization. And they also, to a large extent, blame America, blame the American elite for its global engagement. They see that as coming at a cost to their own livelihoods, yeah, to their own well-being.
But as a policy dilemma, Elizabeth, how does America resolve the perception, at least, that they're not so much approving of Russia, they just sort of don't mind Russia that much doing what it's doing, but they actively disapprove of what the Chinese are doing. So the Chinese and Russians and the Chinese, we can call, I think, quite close allies. The new American president, let's call him Donald Trump, treats them as completely different prospects and problems. What does he run into? I mean, it's complicated. I mean, how does he resolve that? What's going to work for him?
Well, I mean, I think he sees Russia in a different light from China, because he doesn't at this point regard Russia as an existential threat, as a serious competitor to the U.S.
Economically.
You know, economically, yeah. I mean, it's a problem for Europe, but that's Europe's problem, as he will probably say. I think China is different. China at one level, the concern about the loss of American jobs and so on over the last few decades and what that has done for many Americans is indeed an issue, and it is a problem, and it is something that, you know, any American president would want to address. The question is sort of entering into a trade and technology war with China the way to do it? Are there better ways of doing it? But that's the difference between in his perception between China and Russia now. Were it to become a case where both the two countries actually enter into a much closer relationship, alliance, and so on, where he believes that crucial American interests are in danger, then that perception may very well change.
Yeah. And sorry, just the last country to mention in this sort of international part is Japan. I mean, it's in the middle of all of this in a way. It's a very powerful economy, with a very, very large, although largely peaceful, military. And Japan is not a member of NATO. Are the Japanese treated then differently to other current allies of America? So not in NATO, it's not in Europe. It's out there. It's in a part of the world that Trump is probably more interested in, or the Americans are more interested in than Eastern Europe. What do we know about Japanese diplomacy? What do we know about their impulses and where they would stand? Would the Japanese go to war if the Americans did with the Chinese? I mean, we spoke earlier of the possibility of war. What would they do?
So I think what is important to note is, of course, that over the last couple of years, and I think it was it was last year, I think, that they took a decision to really ramp up their defense expenditure, to purchase new weapons and so on and so forth. This is a country that in the post-Second World War period, in its constitution, had embraced
pacifism,
a small pacifism, and having a small, really defensive unit. So there is a very real concern about the rising geopolitical threats in its neighborhood. It also has differences with China, some of the islands, and also, let's not forget, with Russia. And the negotiations with Russia came to an end with the Russian invasion of Ukraine in February 2022. So it is very mindful of the fact that things are getting tougher and getting more difficult for Japan, and that Japan has to build up its defenses and has to have actually an offensive, a degree of offensive capability in order to defend itself. But it also doesn't want to see a serious escalation that would require it to actually use its offensive capabilities. I was in Japan a few months ago, and obviously one of the new important terms in both the West and in Japan and Australia is the concept of the Indo-Pacific. The way in which the U.S. has posited that concept is in many ways very security and military focused. Many Japanese are arguing that the term Indo-Pacific should also, and from their perspective, should focus much more on economic cooperation and development. And this is about them trying to balance between their American ally, which also has troops on Japanese soil, and of course their two big neighbors to the west, China and Russia.
Yeah. So Elizabeth, let's just bring it all down to South Africa at the moment. So everything, ever since the invasion of Ukraine and our, I would have thought, tepid response to it, we've been kind of struggling, I think, to rebalance our foreign policy. When Mandela came to power, I clearly remember the foreign policy sort of foundations were human rights and democracy. And that's no longer the case. I mean, it just doesn't, they don't feature anymore. We now talk about, targeted or active non-alignment, whatever that might mean. And I think the new foreign minister, Ronald Lamola, was talking at your institute at the SIA the other day, was talking about active non-alignment. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, what's your assessment of where we are currently in the world now? Is it generally accepted that you can be actively non-aligned, or have we taken sides, or do people think we've taken sides, whether we have or whether they think might be just as important as maybe equally important? Where are we, and are we in a safe space?
So perceptions matter. You're very right. We've seen that in the way in which many American policy, well, particularly Congress, I think, has responded in the first instance to our position on the war in Ukraine, and also more recently to our position on Israel. I think just a point about this concept of active non-alignment, which is a new concept, one that was developed by academics in Latin America during the Trump administration, interestingly. And the reasoning behind that was that Trump was at the time sort of pushing and pulling the Latin Americans not to accept any investment, any equipment that was Huawei or other sort of Chinese manufacturers for their infrastructure. And the Latin Americans were saying, well, actually, these are affordable. These provide a sort of, complete solution for us. We should be able to to make that decision independently of being in or being seen to be in a particular camp. So we are not in active non-alignment is about not being in any camp automatically. So we're not in the Western camp or in the Eastern camp or whatever camp from the beginning. It depends on the particular issue. We will make a choice depending on the issue. And so, and we sort of hold very dear our independent foreign policy. So that's where it came from. Of course, with the war in Ukraine, it's now being taken into a peace and security context. And many of the Latin Americans have argued that it doesn't necessarily mean neutrality, nor should it be confused with the non-aligned movement. Okay, it's something different. Non-alignment is a foreign policy is a foreign policy posture. Now, the question arises is whether we have, particularly in the case of Ukraine, adopted an active non-alignment. And I would say here, perceptions matter. I think we've tried to rectify it by becoming involved in the African Peace Initiative last year, although that hasn't really sort of shaken the process.
Tree. Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, much. Yeah.
I think the problem, one of the key problems for South Africa in sort of taking this posture has been that from the beginning we were not the government was not coordinated in the way in which it articulated its position. We had at the outset the statement by the foreign ministry, which quite clearly said this was an invasion and that Russian troops needed to pull out. And then over the ensuing period, you know, different actors from the ANC, from different government departments, began to sort of put their own views across. So the first,
well, I mean that first statement lasted all of 2 hours.
Yeah.
Before they retracted it, before Cyril, President Cyril Ramaphosa, instructed them to withdraw it.
Yeah, I think it is.
That was quite extraordinary.
Yeah, I think it's still on the website, by the way.
Yes, it is. It is. Yeah.
But that, to my mind, I mean, two things are important to bear in mind here. The first is that the issue of the principles in the UN Charter. South Africa has always emphasized that we hold these sort of homey, right? We support the principles of the UN Charter. And here you had a blatant invasion. So that, on the one hand, should have been clear. The other one is that if it is difficult, and all countries have to face these dilemmas, that you don't want to upset a country that you're in a grouping with and that you have a strong historical links with, how do you communicate in a way that doesn't, in effect, accept that this is okay.
Yeah.
And I think that we hadn't really. I think the government was taken by surprise in the sense that I don't think they expected the invasion to happen. And so you know they were at sixes and sevens when it did. I think it requires us to really think in a much more carefully about how we respond to such difficult situations where you have ostensible partners and friends actually not adhering to the UN Charter. How do you respond in a way that doesn't sacrifice your principles? While at the same time advancing what I think is a correct approach, just to say we need to look at the opportunities, we need to look at creating platforms to build confidence, to create opportunities for peace. I don't think that would have been appropriate in February, March, April, probably most of 2022. But I think, on the Ukraine war, I feel that in the end we will end up in some sort of talks. And the question is how many more people have to die for that to happen.
Yeah.
Principle was correct. The execution, though, in terms of the peace dimension, I think has been wanting.
Yeah. So if you're looking at us from Washington, then so we are not condemning Russia openly for invading a sovereign country. In Gaza, we have taken Israel, which is a strong US ally, to the International Court of Justice. I think the more I think about it, quite rightly, it was a strong case they presented. They did very well. There's a lot of support for the South African position. Are we in a safe space now, or do we still have a bit more work to do diplomatically? I mean, we're trying to have our cake and eat it here a little bit, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that is a bit of that. I think I would agree with you that on the case against Israel in the ICJ, I think this was a really good approach to take to use the institutions of global governance to bring a case,
Yeah.
and I think it was executed very well. Of course, it did
Yeah.
create, and many have said the fact that South Africa has criticized the West about double standards when it comes to Ukraine compared to other conflicts.
Yeah.
Well, one can probably say the same about us. We haven't been very consistent, certainly with those
No.
two conflicts in mind. And I think what is critical is that these two conflicts happen at a time when the geopolitics are really, really, really at their height. They could probably
Yeah.
go higher. And so any action that is seen by either the one side or the other as going counter to what they see as very critical national interests is bound to
Yeah.
elicit a kind of response that we've seen in the US. I think the steps for us in the next few weeks is really to think very carefully about the strategy of engaging the US and the US
Yeah.
Congress on AGOA in particular, and more broadly the
Yep.
relationship between the two countries, because I think this non-alignment is a very difficult dance in the current context.
Absolutely.
And I think
Yeah.
we're going to
So
have to
we
really think about what is the narrative that we're going to project, and where do we sort of meet the Americans? And it
Yeah.
doesn't
Well,
necessarily have to
exactly,
be halfway, but where do we meet them?
yeah. I was just looking at I mean, the key thing about our trade with America and our trade with China is that we run a huge trade surplus with America, and I think we run a very large trade deficit with the Chinese. We import a lot of stuff from China, and we export a lot of stuff to America, cars and things like that, high value manufactured stuff which we don't get to sell in the China. So, getting towards the end here, what do we do now? So we've got AGOA to talk more about in the US coming up. There is a I'm not sure of a status. You probably know better than I do, but there's both certainly in somewhere in one of the houses of Congress that now I'm asking the president for a review of relations with South Africa, a formal review. What do you advise this government to do in advance of the US election? Do we have the diplomats? Do we have the diplomatic clout, the intellect in our policy, in our institution? Well, not institutions, in the government, to affect the future of US policy towards us in a Trump administration? I mean, we've got to be ready for this. We can't be taken by surprise by what's going to happen there, surely.
No, I do think we have. I think we have some really fine diplomats. I think people who are actually thinking about these issues and recognize the challenges. I think it's also been the case that a recognition that it's very important to speak to both sides. When you go to the US, given the upcoming election, and that it will be important to connect both with key Trump people as well as with the administration and with Congress. We've last year And there were a couple of trips to the U.S., one including the National Security Advisor, another one also with the business delegation, and then also, I think this year, with Foreign Minister at the time, Dr. Naledi Pandor. I think we need to make sure that we develop a coordinated strategy and be very clear about who needs to be there and who they will need to see. When I think the National Security Advisor went to Washington, it was a bit of, well, you know, he's not the minister. You know, he's not being in the presidency.
Who is this guy?
Who is this guy? It needs to be very clear. The hierarchy needs to be very clear. And the strategy needs to be very clear. And that strategy has to be not only to explain, again, why we have taken certain positions, but also to very importantly make the case that this is, that in fact we are not, you know, we're not arming Hamas. We're not recognizing Hamas or believing that Israel does not have a right to exist. In the case of Ukraine, we're trying to be positive actors in pushing through the African Peace Initiative, focusing on food, focusing on children that were kidnapped, and I forget now the third thing, and that we can actually work together in resolving some of these conflicts in a way that that addresses and covers both our national interests. But we need to make the case to them why it's important not to alienate South Africa, not at a time when certainly in Europe there was a great deal of concern after the Ukraine war about why the global South is not supporting us and so on and so forth, and so a little bit of a dissonance in terms of, you know, where developing countries were coming from and where the West was coming from. And I think that needs to all be part of a sort of coherent strategy that might have a number of legs. But that needs to be executed in a coordinated fashion. And the last thing about Goa, of course, and this point was made, I think, very clearly by the business delegation there last year, was that our exports to Goa are not just going to affect, if they were to be terminated, would not just affect South African companies. They would also affect companies in the SACA region because we're part of regional value chains. And so that's another important point which I think needs to constantly be made.
But I liked what you said.
Sorry.
Yeah. I like what you said about, you know, let's not send officials over there to Washington to sort out our problems, that you need to meet face-to-face, leader-to-leader, or minister to, you know, Secretary of State. And, of course, we have a huge opportunity next year because South Africa assumes the presidency of the G20 in 2025. And that means that there will be a G20 summit in South Africa. I'm not sure. Do you know, Elizabeth, where that's going to be yet? Has that been decided?
I don't know if it's been decided.
Oh, okay.
I'm not sure because, of course, we have a new cabinet, and many of these things, of these issues, including the priorities, will be on the table. I think over the next.
But there's a G20 summit. It'll be an opportunity for Cyril Ramaphosa to host Donald Trump, if he is the president by then, in South Africa, if he will come. You know, it's because he's perfectly capable of deciding to play golf instead of coming to a G20 summit. He'll kiss it off with, you know, some terrible comment about, you know, talking shop or whatever it might be. But if he were to come, and there'll be a lot of pressure for him to come, I'm sure, from Congress and his government, because Africa may be poor, but it's not, you know, it's a big piece of real estate and not to be simply tossed aside. What an amazing opportunity for South Africa in this G20 presidency to make our case, not only for South Africa, but for all of the things that we want, you know, reform in global institutions in the UN, IMF, World Bank. I'm sure we are. but you'll know more than I do. Are we ready for the are we ready for G20? Are we going to make maximum use of it?
Well, I think I know that our civil servants and the different government departments have been working really hard on identifying priorities and putting together the dossiers, which at the end of the day obviously have to be tabled at cabinet, and cabinet needs to take a decision both on the sort of two or three key issues as well as in the various working groups. This is a huge undertaking. And I think very much a recognition of its importance. This is also an opportunity, given what the G20 is, which is, premier economic forum on global economic governance, for us to really be able to put on the agenda as chair a number of key issues that we want to push on international financial architecture reform in particular, whether we're talking about debt, whether we're talking about how you scale up finance for climate issues, and so on, and how we, make sure that social issues related to the just energy transition are not sort of left by the wayside, in the same way that Brazil has highlighted the importance of inequality during its G20 presidency. I think a Donald Trump presidency will make some of these issues much more difficult. I imagine that increasing the role of other countries and some of these international financial institutions, or being able to issue more special drawing rights that go to developing countries at the IMF, would probably not be something that the administration would support. But nevertheless, I think it's an opportunity for us to put it on the table. And, of course, to bear in mind that the US will be chairing the G20 after South Africa. I think there's the added incentive for him to come here, and we'll tell him we have
perhaps the great man will be vulnerable to some serious Ramaphosa flattery, and we should hope so. Elizabeth Sideropoulos, thank you, despite your voice, despite your not being well, thank you so much for joining. We'll stop it there. It was a lovely, lovely conversation. I really appreciate your insights. I hope you get better soon. And thank you for listening. I'll be back soon with another edition of Podcast from the Edge. Until then, please take care. Bye for now.